Oh, starting again. Okay.
Okay.
You love the Mercy Peace.
Well, I just love the well, I mean, I think it was making me think about text and image, you know, in the way we've been emailing about with the overlay text and the song you were playing. It was making me think about I don't know, it you know, I'm not going to be able to quote it, but it's talking about, you know, oh, the glory of language, when will it come through, and you know, God, when will that language come through? And putting aside the whole question of God and deity right now, I think that for me, that question of a kind of, I don't know, a kind of a language that is effective or glorious, you know, is one of those questions. You know, I'm constantly been reading a lot of Kafka recently and thinking of the sort of, you know, Kafka would say things like there's hope but no hope for us, you know, so when is there that a language that's hopeful?
It sounds like Jean Amory also. You've read him, yes? Yeah, it sounds like that. Pierre Martin, who is a friend of mine, said it's one and works with this kind of material, said it's one of his favorite books,
The Amory book.
The Amory, yeah.
Well, the whole book is powerful, although there's those particular sections which I think struck me, and I know you've written on it in the past, where he talks about how the world gets shattered or torn, in that moment when it's, and not just violence, but the violence of someone, the sense that there's no one to help you, and the violence of people you don't expect to be violent to you. And I, you know, in my life, I've had that feeling of the world being torn, and it's very traumatic, and it does, you know, I've had that impact of it kind of filtering up to my voice and to my writing, but certainly my voice, my, you know, I talked to you for a while about this sense that I used to have of a constant you know, globus, the lump in the throat that I felt was a physiological response to some, you know, a traumas that I'd had. That really did relate to this kind of sense of world ripping.
Kristallnacht, by the way, we have a book. I think I've mentioned this to you before, a book of 351, something like that, testimonials about Kristallnacht that are mostly anonymous that were published by a Holocaust institution in London. And just, they're not ordered or anything, but a lot of the people there talk about how they had German neighbors who were friendly to them and so forth and so on. And then suddenly these neighbors would be rounding them up and it gave them no ground to stand on. And when they would be helping them outside. And then when they were rounded up and brought into the camps, because some of them went to Buchenwald and some of them were just in holding pens, kind of then they had the crap beat out of them basically by people that they had known. And it just everything changed overnight. And I sort of worry that that kind of seething, you know, is very much at play here right now. You know, there's a white guy on a motorcycle. I wrote about that a couple of days ago. Was going down Westminster Street on a big, looked like a big Harley or something, and on the back he had an American flag, and it said, if you don't. And a sign on it saying, if you don't love, something like, if you don't love my flag, I'll help you leave. No, and it just, this kind of ugly provocation.
And of course, there the word, we know perfectly well the word help there doesn't mean help. It means I'll hit you and I'll help you leave.
I'll destroy your home is what it means. If this, if this is not, if you don't accept the conditions of my home, I will destroy the conditions of yours because you are foreign and you are alien by virtue of the color of your skin or whatever. You know.
And so words like home kind of get shattered, and it's like this world shattering in Amory, and that extends out to you know, extends out to certain everyday words, and then eventually all the words. And what you're just thinking almost makes me think of, you know, neighborhoods and what we assume from a neighbor, as compared to something like a a police state, and then with that the space of the camp, you invoke the camps. You know, one of the things, and I don't know enough about Kristallnacht and the people you're talking about, but you know, one of the things in the story you just told that I hear is this kind of almost extension of the camps into their neighborhood, because as you said, the people who maybe they knew were then in the camps and beating the shit out of them. So in some ways you discover the camp is everywhere, or what you, at least the place you thought was one kind of thing is not, it's a place of violence.
Yeah, and that violence seems to adhere to you. I find that Azra and I have both, you know, we can't go out here that much. We've gone out today a little bit and yesterday a little bit. And those are the first 2 days we've gone out in a row, I think, in the past 3 months. And we actually took the car and went somewhere, but usually we don't. And I find that I'm living in a state of, like, particularly with the kind of rioting that goes on here really, really late at night, or the setting off of cherry bombs in the neighborhood, or something heavier, I don't know what they are, some explosions in the neighborhood, that when I try writing, for example, just as something like as simple as typing,
yeah,
and I have to reread it 2 or 3 times because I will literally be substituting words.
Yeah.
In other words, my thought processes, you know, if you're a touch typist, which I am, I think you are also.
Yeah.
You type the word there, it's like this, and you don't even think about it. It's
right.
It's learned behavior. So there's parallel processes going on. You're thinking and then you're typing. But I found that if I don't go back and reread it, I don't discover that what's actually happening is my fingers will be typing one thing and I'll be thinking another. And it's really frightening. It's a kind of schizoid process. And I think it's happening to a lot of people. This sort of breakdown of the psyche, this fragmentation, you know, which we know from Schreber and everything, but this breakdown of the psyche and its coherence, because you simply have no say about what's going on outside of your immanence, you know, your immanent self, your immanent territory.
Do you feel there's a, I don't know, do you feel there's a, what's the word I'm thinking, trying to think of, an insistence to the ones that you mistype? Is there a consistency, or is it a generalized disorder?
I think it's a generalized disorder. Yeah. It's a little more frightening.
So that's a kind
not
of
not as if I'm reading a psychoanalytical text beneath the surface, as far as I know.
Yeah,
but it's like going somewhere else. Or
I mean, it seems like one thing you're describing is a breakdown of, weirdly enough, the way you described it, a breakdown of our automatisms or habit. Right, habit is a part of, again, part of familiar space, part of all the things we take. You know, and you know, we've had this, we all know this, but we've had this ongoing, you know, before the protests, the quarantine, and it's all together. This, so, you know, all the automatisms, and then what are you left with? You're left with this kind of raw, you know, stripped bare self once all those things are, if they start breaking down.
Yeah, they feel like we have these. But I'm sort of fascinated by these plants we find in the woods here, or pieces of wood rather, that seem to have fungal incrustations on them. And the crustations are actually much harder than the wood was. Mm-hmm. They're really dense and they sort of follow the outline of the wood. And I sort of think, I think that has something, it's sort of a metaphor for me. It's something that becomes impenetrable, seems to follow this shape of ordinary reality, but in fact, there's something quite alien.
Do you feel, well, okay. I mean, because I was thinking at first that, you know, I was thinking at first that you'd in the last couple of conversations we've had, you've invoked the term body armor.
Character armor, yeah, for, you know, from
character,
Reich.
From Reich.
Yeah.
But, you know, the
this is, I just want to show you this.
Sure.
This is what, I don't know if this is, can you put the light on up there? This might just come through. This is the
kind
of weird.
Yeah. So is that a fungus?
It's a coating on a piece of wood that is totally like there. You can see the white.
It almost looks metallic.
Yeah, it's very strange. Yeah. And we found these things all over the place. So it looks like fungus has interpenetrated the wood and then taken it over and followed the shape of it and added a crusted layer. Very odd.
Yeah, so there is that sense of being stripped down to something that's just I see the word crab on my screen, like a crab, right, down to
a shell. Yeah, ontologically stripped, how's that?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting, you know, Reich, you know, with the character armor, he had those weird maps where he could map, like, you know, exactly where the armoring was, but it does strike me that he also then thought of our language and actually the very condition of speaking as being like a blockage in that armor, like because the armor is so hardened, that's why you talk, right? I'm not going to say that quite right, but I get the sense of as the armor dissolves our kind of or breaks down our patterns of our patterns of speech break down too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's certainly our words. That makes sense to me. It would be interesting to put out there and see how many people are having some kind of it's not dyslexia, some kind of
I think isn't the term cognitive dissonance, something like
cognitive
that?
Cognitive dissonance, yeah. Which again, they you know does have this idea then you have dissonance. Whatever it is to kind of reduce the cognitive dissonance is a way of reducing the kind of stimulus and the impact on the organism, you know, and I think, you know, mental health professionals are finding tremendous spikes in anxiety and mental health.
Everywhere right now. Yeah. I drove for the first time today, by the way.
Did you?
Yeah, for the past 2 months, Azure's been doing most of the, almost all the, maybe all the driving. We were trying to figure that out. But today was the first day I actually remember driving. And one of the things that was, because I was worried. I was worried that I would literally be seeing a lane where there wasn't a lane or, a car coming towards me where there wasn't. None of that happened, thank God. Yeah. But, you know, with the typing, it's kind of sending a signal to me. It's not dementia. It's nothing like that. It's something... it's a continual derailment.
Yeah. Yeah. So the visual and typing, cause you're still just as productive. You're still putting out work.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, music helps. Music saves me in a way because it's an immediate response. And I'm
you're not going wrong in music. You don't feel like you're,
No, I feel that actually I try to go wrong in music because I don't know if I told you this, but I've been very influenced. I think it was Hokusai who in his older age, when he was older, was doing enormous paintings outside on the ground and things like that. And he talked about he was an old man mad about painting. So he felt in a way that he was freed to do whatever he wanted to do.
Yeah.
Thanks. And I thought, so if I'm playing music now that I feel is ugly, I find that really, really interesting. So, and I put up this piece of music. I forget what it was. It was called Sirens. It was solo shakuhachi, which I'm not very good at, and I was breaking a lot of shakuhachi playing rules. I wasn't trying to do anything that's traditional, but I was just seeing where it was taking me, and that was after Sirens here on and on and on in the neighborhood here. And interestingly, for me, there's a well-known shakuhachi player, because I might put this up, I won't give his name, but who really liked it and then did a collaboration with me. Somebody who's actually famous for his playing and his shakuhachi making. And so I felt that he gave me kind of approbation for that. You know, it's okay what you're doing.
Well, Alan, so you're not mad at music the way the other guy was mad at painting, but you're
mad about painting. It was
mad about it, like mad,
not mad at painting, mad about painting.
Oh, I heard mad at painting.
Yeah,
like he was doing him big because he was mad about contemporary painting. Well, that makes more sense. Well, and that's got that kind of fury passion as well. You know, passion is in that sense of being taken, right?
And mad about's an interesting phrase because it implies both being obsessed by something in very possibly a very positive sense, but it also implies madness, of course.
Yeah, kind of a limit thing. You know, and there is that kind of all that stuff about the art of madman and so on, but that's not really what we're talking about. But you know, who's it like Art Brut and things like this?
Art Brut, yeah. Du Buffet also, you know.
Yeah, Du Buffet. You know, the sirens are interesting because they're a kind of parasite, but it's a kind of you know, a noise parasite that's coming in, but it's a very institutional parasite, right? I mean, it's interrupting things, but it.
You mean the sirens going on outside here?
Yeah, that's kind of.
Yeah.
Although when you first said sirens, you called the piece Sirens. I was thinking of the women and the Greek women and luring people into the rocks. You know.
What is it? I was thinking of Cyrene. Is that all? Is Cyrene also a name for manatee?
Yeah.
Yeah, Cyrene, Sirene.
The family of Sirene.
Oh, yeah.
So I read the family of Sirenia, and Ezra and I are advocates for manatees, seriously advocates for manatees.
Did I tell you, we saw them, we were in Florida after Christmas and saw manatees that basically live in the hot water blooming out of a power plant. So
yeah.
This is outside of Fort Myers. So there's a, they just kind of thrive there in like a, I don't know what it is. It's about a quarter of a mile backwash behind in the canal behind.
Manatees are related to elephants and I think to aardvarks. And the nearest relative to the elephant is the elephant shrew. Do you know about that?
It's a tiny thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about, I don't know, it's about this long. And it has a proboscis, but it's actually genetically very similar to the elephant.
Mm. So, you know, but I was also thinking when I thought that I don't know what to make of that, right?
Yeah. It's neat.
It is neat. Well, you know, but so I was thinking about, I was also thinking about number stations, though, because they're another kind of voice coming in from nowhere. That relates to, that makes me think of some of this, you know, the tuning into the number stations and
which I've done a lot of.
I think nobody's ever really tackled them in some kind of philosophical, cultural, theoretical way. I mean, I think there's collections of the recordings on number stations, but I think the sort of why they're interesting and what they are hasn't been taken.
I think out. I've written about them, and there was a magazine called Review of International Broadcasting, which I wrote some articles that sort of applied to those, and also to apply to the Russian over the horizon radar, which was going on at the time. Somebody was bringing up number stations again today, and they haven't vanished; they're still there.
Yeah,
but there's also I have a book that I don't have it here, so I can't give you the title, but it's in the other room, that I just got on really early radio, really early radio broadcasting, Marconi and those people, and Fessenden and what's his name? I'm losing track, but a number of people that the guy who invented the vacuum tube, not DeForest, I forget. Anyway, so all of these people, and so they were all doing very early broadcasting, you know, across transatlantic things, experimental stuff. And so there was a lot of popular writing about radio at the time. And oh, here's the book. Asher brought out, Inventing American Broadcasting.
Oh, yeah, okay.
It's pretty interesting. So, yeah. And it talks about how there was also a lot of publicity about early radio because people had no idea that if you're here and there's something else there, that you can actually have a signal going between a space. What that meant, it was all seen as in popularly as mysterious. So they related it also to signals, immediately related it to signals from the cosmos, mm-hmm. so the unknown. And so we're dealing, we're part of the universal, the talking, the speaking of the universe.
Yeah.
And we're also listening to the universe. And if you're doing like, you know, we did VLF radio, and if you're doing VLF radio, you are in fact listening to the universe. You're hearing light going around, you're hearing crackles from cosmic rays, you're hearing all sorts of stuff. So all of that, I think there's been a lot of writing on that.
Well, and there's all this stuff on like the, you know, the wow signal and all these things, listening for repeated signals, which, you know, don't interest me per se. Hold on one sec, Alan. Can you hold on one sec?
Sure.
Yeah. Hey, what's up?
I'll turn this off and start over.